It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich in for Jane Hamden. Good morning. There's no shortage of kiss-and-tell celebrity memoirs in the biography section of your local bookstore. A few of them are good, some of them okay, but many are merely strings of showbiz anecdotes, often by people who have only been in the public eye for a short time. When Alan Alda sat down to write his autobiography more than 30 years after he first gained fame as Hawkeye Pierce on the TV show MASH, he says he wanted to write a different sort of book, one that really explained why he became the person he is. The result is called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, and it's just been released in paperback. Alan Alda talked about the book with Lake Effect's Bonnie North.
You know, I never wanted to write a book, although I had been asked a number of times. Once I got famous, once MASH started, people would say, oh, you want to write a book? And I knew what they meant. They wanted me to write a show business memoir in which I told about all the jobs I'd had. And that doesn't interest me, except insofar as they throw light on something more personal, something more interesting, you know, something a little more... and maybe even universal. You know, I think it's true that if you can tell a personal story in a truthful way, in a way that really captures it, it can get to be a little universal. And I was interested in doing a piece of writing and not in revealing things about a celebrity. You know, in this case, me. There is stuff about my work life in it, but it's really only insofar as it throws light on the real story, which is the story of this kid who has this bizarre beginning. I mean, I had a very strange life, and as I grew up, I had to learn how to become a person and how to live spontaneously. I wanted to live spontaneously, and the beginnings weren't like that.
When you say spontaneous, I would think growing up around vaudeville would be wonderfully spontaneous.
Well, in many ways it was. I mean, in many ways my life was a little too spontaneous. From the time I was born until I was about 3 or 4, I was in the wings watching burlesque, you know, naked ladies dancing and burlesque comics and going out to have beers with the comics at the age of 3, things like that. That may be slightly too spontaneous, you know. And my poor mother was psychotic, so life was very uncertain. To the extent that the spontaneous life is uncertain, mine was way uncertain with my mother, because I never knew when I was hearing from her something about reality or something that was skewed by her psychosis. She was schizophrenic and paranoid, thought I was trying to kill her a good deal of the time. And when I wasn't trying to kill her, she thought other people were trying to kill her. So I think my life with her made me a little wary of uncertainty. And I had to learn how to welcome it, how to accept it, how to surf it in a way. It wasn't helpful to me to deal with uncertainty by getting more rigid or trying to hold back change. And the title of the book, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, that's really what it means. The biggest lesson I've learned probably is to let go and not try to hold things in place. When an idea is no longer useful, I try to let it go. When people die, I try to let them go. Not that you don't mourn them, but when my dog died and we stuffed him, that was not a way of holding on to him. He didn't stay around any longer because he was stuffed.
I know you used that phrase later in the book when you were talking about a certain, I forget exactly which acting job, but it was a character you were trying to find, and you said you had to learn to stop stuffing the dog.
Yeah, well, I had to learn it in many instances. And, you know, I'll give you an example of how it really came home to me that was a good image for the things, for many of the things I learned in my life. When this book came out in hardcover last year, I was in a bookstore signing books, and a woman came up to me and said, I'm your fourth cousin, and I have an envelope with some family photos in it you might like. And so I opened it up, and the first picture I saw was a picture of my father with his arms around my dog, the real dog, while he was alive, not the stuffed one.
Not the stuffed one, yeah.
Well, it was astonishing to me because I didn't recognize the dog. I'd have no memory of him looking that way. the way he does in the picture. And the reason for that is that when we got the dog home from the taxidermist, he had been given this horrifying expression on his face by the taxidermist. He scared people. They were afraid to come into the living room. He didn't look like the real dog. But that stuffed animal had replaced in my memory the real dog. It was perfect proof that stuffing him, rather than helping me keep him around, it obliterated the real dog. And in a way, you know, a picture, a photograph is another way of stuffing a dog, but it was a lot less detrimental to my memory than the stuffed animal was. So when we did MASH, that was, in a way, stuffing the experience of all of those real people who had MASH. But we tried to be so, we tried to, through an act of imagination, make it lively, make it as close as we could to real life events. You know, I mean, and right. Imagination, I think, is the key. That can allow you sometimes to go back to the past and see it in some version close to what it might have been instead of some pale imitation of it.
But, you know, people will say that's what theater is, that it's always an imitation. It can never be. You try to get as close to the truth as you can as an actor.
Yeah.
But you're never going to actually do it because it is a representation of a specific emotion or situation.
See, that's why I value spontaneity, because if you just try to imitate the situation or imitate nature, it's flat, I think. But if you add imagination and spontaneity, if you come to life in some way, the life it has can have some of the same power that it had when it had life.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book about finding the character of Hawkeye Pierce through the boots. Mm. You know, that was a key thing to find that, the soul of that particular character.
Yeah, through the soul of the shoes.
Through the soul of the shoes, yeah.
So a lot of actors find the character through the shoes. They put on the shoes. There's a funny story, an old story about a guy playing Lincoln who went to an actor's club for lunch every day while he was rehearsing. And there was an older actor watching him each day from another table. And the young guy came in the first day wearing the shoes that Lincoln would have worn. The next day he was wearing the long, skinny pants. The next day a frock coat. And finally came in with a stovepipe hat and a beard. And the older actor said, "That young man won't be satisfied until someone shoots him." But you do get the idea from the trappings sometimes.
So how did you find, what was it about the boots that let you into him, into that character?
Well, they had been worn by a real soldier, and there was something about the way they felt on my feet that made me know I was in the Army. They didn't really tell me I was Hawkeye. That was harder. I really didn't have any idea how I was going to play that part, even after 10 days of rehearsal. And on the first day of shooting, the first shot was just me walking out of a door in that aluminum building that was on the compound. And I had to just walk across the dirt compound. And there were a lot of extras there playing nurses and stuff. And I thought, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to be this guy. And all I had to do was walk across the thing. So I'm listening, and they're saying, quiet on the set, you know, and I hear the clapperboard, and I'm still thinking, I don't know how to be this guy. And then they call action, and I think, you know what? You got to just jump into this. There's no time to think about this. And I opened the door, and I walked out, and I see a nurse coming toward me. So I just reached out and grabbed her around the waist, and then she responded, and she patted me on the cheek and said hello. I don't know. So I thought to myself, you know, that wasn't so hard. I can be Hawkeye. You know, you never know where you're going to find it. You just, they used to say in improvising, reach into the dark and pull out an answer. And sometimes that's the best way.
Yeah, you talk a lot about improvisation and how important it is. And I think one of the things that's important about improvisation is that it's based in trust and it's based in logic. That it's not just leaping off the cliff and having no idea what's at the bottom.
No. In fact, I think that's a mistake that we all make as amateurs and as beginners in theater work. The idea that you need to abandon yourself to the character is, or to the scene, not usually a good idea, because you're not abandoning means that you're giving up who you are and where you are and what you're going through, when in fact what you're actually going through is some of the great raw material for performing.
Alan Alda. Alda has won 6 Emmy Awards for his work in television, the latest of which is for his portrayal of Senator Arnold Vinnick on the drama The West Wing. He'll talk about that role after a break. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Let's get back to Bonnie North's conversation with Alan Alda. In 2005, Alda was nominated for an Oscar, a Tony, and an Emmy Award. His book, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, has just been released in paperback.
The acting school that you went through, which was growing up in vaudeville and doing all of that, is not what we consider a standard acting training.
Well, it isn't. It isn't. I made the most of it. I never went to formal acting classes. I don't recommend that to anybody else. I don't think it's the right way to do it. It took me extra years to learn how to do what I wanted to do as an actor. But I did have a very, very interesting and unusual education in the theater because I stood in the wings. And watching from the wings, you learn things, you see things that nobody else can see. The interplay of the actors when I would watch them, the comics in burlesque, or my father and Sam Levine doing Guys and Dolls on Broadway, to see the sweat flying off the actors, to see the energy flow between them, to watch Sam Levine, every night he did it a little differently. He didn't decide to do it differently. He just wrote it wherever it went. And the laughs came in different places. Now, that was amazing to me. Because I always thought the laughs, up until that point, I thought the laughs were tied to the funny words in the script and that the laughs would come at the end of the joke. Well, he didn't play it like it was a joke. He played it like it was an event. And he had a sensational sense of humor. So he found, and the audience found, funny things to laugh at various places in his performance. And he, to him, it was an improvisation, although he was always standing in the same place and saying exactly the same words.
Singing the same songs.
That's right. You know, People say, how can you do a play night after night? How can you do the same thing over and over again? Well, if you're lucky, you don't do the same thing over and over again. Although you're saying the same words, it's a different dance. It's like saying, how could you already danced once. Why would you want to dance again at this wedding? Well, because every time you dance, it's different, or it ought to be.
Well, that also leads me to a relatively recent live experience that you had doing Arnold Vinnick on The West Wing, where you and Jimmy Smits actually did a live debate.
Yeah, that was one of the most exciting things I've ever done, because it brought me back to the days when I started, when I was an improviser, although this was written and rehearsed. It wasn't
exactly
improvised.
Companies want to hear, which is why they've given so much money to your campaign.
And your positions on spending, on creating more government jobs, they're exactly what the public employee unions want to hear, and that's why they've poured money into your campaign. You want to talk about conflict of interest?
Well, who's throwing cheap accusations?
It felt like an improvisation in many ways because it was so dangerous. We were doing it completely live. And when I say that, I have to say it 2 or 3 times so people get it usually. It wasn't live on tape. You know, we didn't do it all the way through while they taped it and then they played it later. While we were doing it, the people were watching it in New York. And then we waited a couple hours and did it again while they watched in California. And they were different shows, different audience in the room with us. And you didn't know if you'd forget your lines and suddenly be in a different part of the play at any point, or just get to the end and have 10 minutes with nothing to do. You know, I mean, it was just scary enough to be exciting. But by this time, I was so comfortable with uncertainty that it was for me was very exciting, and I really loved it.
How did you find Arnold Vinnick as a character?
You know, I don't think about the characters too much as characters. I base everything that I do on what the characters want. I find out what they want and how they intend to get what they want, or how they tend to go about getting what they want. And then I try to see how I can want what they want. And in fact, it's more than just wanting what they want. When I get to the point where I feel I deserve to get what this guy wants, really deserve it, whether it's to rule the world or to knock off this liquor store, whatever it is, I deserve it. And when I get to that point, then I lighten up on it a lot. I mean, it's not, there's no pressing to make the point. And that's when the acting kind of disappears. So you see, I don't think in terms of what the person is like. Because to the extent that I can identify in words what the character is, then I'm stuffing the dog a little bit. I'm encapsulating the character. I'm making it knowable. For me, it has to stay discoverable. Once I know it, it's kind of dead.
Well, that spontaneity that you talk about has
to
be.
Yeah, yeah. Spontaneity means to me to be always finding out more about it. I'm curious about the characters. And I find staying like that gives me a chance to understand more dimensions to the character the longer I play the character. It keeps it from being a one-note experience.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about fame. You talk about it in the book.
Yeah.
Did you expect it to affect you as it has?
Well, I didn't know what to expect. Except that I didn't think I was going to like it. My father was very famous when I was growing up. He was a movie star, and then he was a stage and television star. And fame always seemed like an interruption. I mean, I was about 8 or 9 years old, and we were walking down Hollywood Boulevard just shortly after he got famous. And what looked like a 16-year-old girl ran up behind us and punched him in the back and swore at him and ran on. And my parents, I was really upset. I didn't know what was happening. And they said, well, you know, some people have a funny reaction when they see famous people. They don't know what to do. And I thought, I don't want to get famous. What is this?
You're going to hit me.
And people really did have a peculiar reaction when I got famous. People would grab at me. And, you know, television fame it involves a lot of people in the audience. And there's a variety of responses, and most of them tend to pull at you in some way. Either they're physically pulling at you, or they write you letters with intimate details in them about their lives and asking for things. I got a number of letters from people who were thinking of suicide and wanted me to give them a word of wisdom that would save their lives. Well, that's kind of a big task for a television actor. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I didn't sign on for that. I felt guilty that I couldn't think of something to say that I thought would be helpful. You know, I mean, it's a very weird position to find yourself in.
And have you found that now that you've written the book and now it's out in paperback, that people who are either suffering from paranoid schizophrenia or who have relatives write to you and say, what do I do? How do I help my friend?
No, I don't get that so much. I thought you were going to say, do I find now when people look at my acting, they still want to kill themselves? No, I've gotten much better now. Now they just want to go get drunk for a while.
Right.
But
yeah.
No, I get, on the contrary, I do get some response from people who say, my mother was schizophrenic or my brother is schizophrenic, and I know what you went through. You know, people talk about it more now. When I was a kid, no one talked about it. No one in the whole culture would discuss mental illness. And that made it very difficult for families who had mentally ill people in the family. Because you didn't have a strategy you could discuss with somebody. You know, how are we going to handle this? You didn't even just say what this was. It was just that everybody walked around with a heavy expression because it was hard that day to get through the day.
Was writing the book sort of a way to kind of come to terms with all of that?
No, I know it probably seems like it was, that it would be, but it wasn't. I had come to terms with most of this before I wrote the book. The book was, for me, a chance to write something as well as I could, and I had some really good, I thought, raw material to write about. You know, I had a story that I knew well because I had lived it. There were things that happened to me in the course of writing it, but I didn't write it in order to get some kind of solace. It wasn't therapy for me to do it. It was a chance to to do a, I hoped, a good piece of writing. But the interesting thing was, I did find something out about myself in the course of it, which was that as interested as I am in science, I'm very, very curious about science, I realized that I really had not spent much time learning about schizophrenia. All these hundreds of scientists I've interviewed on my science show on PBS, I just never learned that much about that mental problem. I think because it was too painful for me.
Well, I know I've got to let you go, but I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading a little something.
Now, this is the very beginning of the book. My mother didn't try to stab my father until I was six, but she must have shown signs of oddness before that. Her detached gaze, the secret smile, something. We were living in a two-room apartment over the dance floor of a nightclub. My father was performing in the show that played below us every night, and we could hear the musical numbers through the floorboards, and we had heard the closing number at midnight. My father should have come back from work hours ago. My mother had asked me to stay up with her. She was lonely. We played Gin Rummy as the band below us played Brazil, and couples danced through the haze of booze and cigarette smoke late into the night. Finally, he came in. She jumped up, furious. "Where have you been?" she screamed. Even at the age of six, I could understand her anger. He worked with half-naked women and came home late. It wasn't crazy to be suspicious. She told him she knew he was sleeping with someone. He denied it. "You are," she screamed. He denied it again, this time impatiently. "You son of a bitch," she said. She picked up a paring knife and lunged at him, trying to plunge it into his face. This was crazy.
Alan Alda, thank you so much for coming in. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Alan Alda was in Milwaukee last week to speak at Alverno College. He spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. Alan Alda's book, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, was just released in paperback. There's an extended version of his interview on our website, WUWM.com. Click on Lake Effect. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.